Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. On today's show, we'll feature an interview with Reese Ehrlich, U.S. foreign policy analyst and author, to discuss his new book about U.S. policy involving Cuba. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
After a five-year struggle against Bell South and Cox Cable, the town of Lafayette, Louisiana, began offering its new fiber-optic broadband service last week. The project, which is expected to be completed by 2011, will be the biggest publicly owned fiber network in the country. Attorney Jim Baller got involved in the fight for community internet in Lafayette in 2005 when Bell South pressured the Louisiana state legislature to block the project. The proposed law would have imposed a series of obstacles preventing the community from offering internet service that competed with the phone and cable companies. Then-Governor Kathleen Blanco all but locked Baller in a room with Bell South and Cox until they came up with a compromise.
The way we negotiated was to take each and every one of the provisions, line by line, go through it and say, this can't work. What are you doing, Bell South and Cox? Are you complying with anything like this yourself? And provision after provision, they responded that no, they weren't.
Even after the compromise, Bell South, now known as AT&T, continued to fight against the Lafayette project.
Bell South had a lapse of memory as to what it had agreed to in the bill, and it started a series of lawsuits that ended up tying up Lafayette in litigation over the course of the next two and a half years. And ultimately, the Supreme Court of Louisiana resolved the issue unanimously in Lafayette's favor, clearing the project to move forward.
Lafayette fiber broadband services will be faster and cheaper than the competition. With speeds ranging from 10 to 50 megabits per second, the 30 megabit per second tier costs $45. AT&T offers a maximum of 6 megabits per second for $43. The basic video tier includes 19 channels and costs $17. Customers are already subscribing to phone, television, and internet services through Lafayette fiber.
Are corporate marketers preying on kids for profit? According to a new film, advertisers want to create consumers for life, and they're branding every aspect of childhood, from TV, toys, internet games and DVDs, to clothes and food. They're also encouraging children to sit in front of screens for several hours a day, with little regard for children's mental or physical health. Adriana Barbaro, producer of Consuming Kids, The Commercialization of Childhood, says the media may pose many health risks for children.
Some studies suggest that heavy television watching changes the way that the brain develops, and it's affecting children's ability to learn and leading to attention problems such as ADD and ADHD. There are many studies linking children's exposure to violence, to violent and aggressive behavior, and to anxiety and depression and to sleep problems in children.
Studies also show that marketing of junk food to children is escalating, and it's led to an epidemic of obesity in children.
So for the first time in modern times, children's life expectancies that are born today are shorter than that of their parents.
Aside from physical and mental health risks, she says, there is also a larger effect on society.
It's the values that kids are learning. There's the message that kids are getting over and over again at earlier and earlier ages is that it's about me. It's about me now. Instant gratification. Material values in the sense that what you are and what you own and what you buy defines you. So it's really a disservice to kids because we're teaching them to look outside of themselves for happiness and satisfaction. And so they're always going to be chasing after the next, you know, greatest and latest thing.
Barbaro says that everyone must get involved to change marketing practices to children.
So many parents, just from the research I've done, are seeing changes in their kids. And a lot of the times they're not linking it and don't recognize that what kids are putting in their body in terms of their media diet is just as important as the food they're getting in their body and the exercise or whatever else that they're doing, that your media diet has an effect on you. There's a connection. And if you're concerned with the junk food, or if you're concerned with the precocious sexuality or the violence in the media, that it's one industry selling all of these things to your kids. They're undermining your job. They're making your job as a parent, which is already so hard, harder. As a community, we need to support parents, and we really need to support our children. They deserve better.
For more information about consuming kids, visit the Media Education Foundation at mediaed.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
Eric Holder, the U.S. Attorney General, has said the first thing to come out of the Obama administration that was refreshingly honest and absolutely necessary to the proper exercise of his duties. In a well-thought-out speech to the U.S. Justice Department commemorating Black History Month, Holder launched a strong critique on the bizarre nature of race relations in the United States. His remarks were clearly crafted to garner news media coverage, as he provoked American macho cowboy pretensions by describing the U.S. as essentially a nation of cowards when it comes to race relations. That was sure to get a rise out of the mushmouths of the corporate media. Much of Holder's remarks were not so much about cowardice, the fear of speaking honestly on racial questions, but an abysmal ignorance. To the extent that Black people are omitted or marginalized in the teaching of American history makes no sense. As Holder pointed out, the study of Black history is essential because the history of Black America and the history of this nation are inextricably tied to each other. For example, said the Attorney General, the history of the United States in the 19th century revolves around a resolution of the question of how America was going to deal with its Black inhabitants. To which I will add, if you don't understand that, you know nothing of your country. It's been only a month since a gaggle of know-nothing, arrogantly racist, and essentially cowardly white men ran the Justice Department. In the space of 8 years, they turned the agency into a den of corruption and criminality, where justice could not be found, and the term civil rights was an epithet. By the time the Bushmen were through, virtually all of the career lawyers that were hired were right-wing ideologues, opposed to the very concept of affirmative action, or the mere idea of diversity. The Justice Department, and especially its Civil Rights Division, had been largely transformed into a racist club. For this reason, it was vitally necessary that the nation's top lawyer use the occasion of Black History Month to shake up the department and let the rest of us know that it's a new day, that George Bush and his Ku Klux Klavern are really gone, something that is not so evident in the rest of the Obama administration. For example, at the Defense Department. Holder reminded his employees that, outside the workplace, there is almost no significant interaction among the races, a situation that does not differ significantly from the country that existed some 50 years ago. Holder juxtaposed the myth of the ethnic melting pot with the reality of racial cowardice. Although Holder didn't mention it, even the term melting pot, as most Americans use it, is based on an incomplete quotation. The term originally came into vogue on the popularity of a 1908 play called The Melting Pot. But the actual words in the play were, "America is God's crucible, the great melting pot where all the races of Europe are melting and reforming." That is, America was a diversity of white people only. And if you don't know that, you don't know white America and its history. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Strapinchik. We now feature an interview with Reese Ehrlich, U.S. foreign policy analyst and author, to discuss his new book about U.S. policy involving Cuba. The following interview was recorded on Wednesday, February 25th, 2009. We are joined on the phone with Reese Ehrlich. Reese Ehrlich is an author and commentator, co-author of the book Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, and author of the recent book Dateline Havana, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Future of Cuba, who is joining us on the phone from Chicago. Reese Ehrlich, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
The book is called Dateline Havana, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Future of Cuba. We're talking, obviously, about the country of Cuba. And could you tell us a little bit more about the book, especially with what you mean by the real story of U.S. policy with regards to Cuba?
The image portrayed by the U.S. government and by conservative Cubans in Miami and New Jersey is that Cuba is this horrible, totalitarian, communist dictatorship. People are afraid to talk to their friends or their family members about what they really think, and that as a result of this lack of democracy, the U.S. must impose a embargo against Cuba, preventing Americans from visiting the island and preventing investments and sales of any Cuban goods and so on. And the real story is a lot different. All you have to do is spend about 5 or 10 minutes in Cuba walking around the streets, and you'll see it's not a totalitarian dictatorship. People talk to you freely. They're, especially as an American, they were very interested to talk to me about what's going on here. Cubans know a lot more about what's going on in the United States than we know what's going on in Cuba. Yes, there's repression, for sure. It's certainly not a free country, but the U.S. consciously over-exaggerates the claim in order to justify its policy. We've seen that process go on in Iraq, where first we decide to invade Iraq, and then we come up with a reason for doing so. So the U.S. continues to try to isolate Cuba. It can't stand the idea that a country that used to be in our backyard, as they used to say, has broken away and been independent, and continues to oppose U.S. Policy around the world. And so then we just come up for some excuses why to carry out that policy. So that's the real story, and I think we're going to see a lot of changes under Obama regarding policy towards Cuba.
You mentioned a number of points there. I'd like to address one of those. Where you refer to that the United States over-exaggerates, Cuban domestic policy with regards to its citizens. Can you elaborate on that? In what way do you find this kind of over-exaggeration, or can you mention an example or two?
Sure. Well, let's take, there's about 210 political prisoners in Cuba, according to Cuban dissidents living on the island, and that's down from the high hundreds 10 years ago. The number have declined steadily. Over 100 or 200 have been released since Raul Castro has come to power. So, and the U.S., just by comparison, had at one point over 700 political prisoners kept in Guantanamo, ironically, and they were people who were charged with being terrorists and enemy combatants, but they were held without trial, without due process. They were tortured. So they meet anybody's definition of political prisoners, but for some reason that was okay because we're fighting terrorism, but when the Cuba jails people, well, that's not okay. That's a sign of being a dictatorship. You talk to Cubans, and they are very upset with the economy. There's very definitely a lot of disagreement, a lot of criticism of the government for very bad economic situation relative to Cuba's history. But you don't hear a lot of people clamoring for a return to the U.S.-sponsored system that existed before 1959, when under Batista you had a horrible dictatorship, the mob running the casinos, rank segregation, all kinds of things that the U.S. Now calls claims was a democratic system. But the people in Cuba know that the choice is not between some idealized democracy where everybody's free to you know, write what they want in the newspaper and hold rallies, and what they have now, the choices between what they have now and what they had before 59, backed by the United States, and they have no desire to return to that.
Why do you think that there's, I mean, that's kind of one peculiarity that strikes me, that the idea is that you've got this maybe imposed dichotomy, that it's either Batista or Castro, and that they couldn't, like, Cuban people or citizens or perhaps some kind of coalition of Cubans and Americans and whoever else might be able to chart a third or fourth or maybe even fifth pathway. Why do you think that there's this kind of forced or imposed dichotomy here?
Well, because I think I have a whole chapter in my book about what would happen in Cuba if they had so-called multi-party democracy and all of the demands that the U.S. makes on Cuba. There's numerous reports that were written by conservative Cubans in Miami and by the Bush administration, transition to democracy. And they all contain the same kind of elements, which is you've got to have free markets and multi-party democracy and free elections and free press, etc. And you've got to get rid of the old communists and the old communist system and blah, blah, blah. But the reality of that is, if in the real world, I mean, we see what happened. The U.S. made the same claims about Afghanistan and Iraq. Right? We were bringing democracy. For the first time, those countries are going to enjoy free elections and free democracy, and we can see the kind of dictatorial system that has evolved in both of those countries, either chaos or, you know, they hold elections, but that hardly makes them democratic. In the case of Cuba, the minute there would be some political instability in Cuba and, let's say, the old system fell, first plane loads of people would be the Miami Cubans coming over with their money and their thugs, because they have armed groups now in Miami, so they would certainly be happy to reestablish those in Cuba. The second plane load would be the drug dealers from Mexico and Colombia and elsewhere, who are excluded from Cuba now. There are no drug cartels. There is no drug problem in Cuba today, but it would be fertile ground under the chaos that would ensue with the end of the old system. And the third set of people on the planes would be the New York mob, because they never got over the fact that they lost Cuba 50 years ago. They had a pretty sweet deal going with the running the casinos and the hotels and the prostitution rings, et cetera, et cetera. So it's far from having a democratic system and free elections and freedom of the press, et cetera. You'd have a version of the thugs and corrupt political parties that you had in the past. And we don't have to go very far to figure that out. You look at Afghanistan today, it's a narco state, and the danger from the narcotics doesn't come from the Taliban, although they deal in drugs. It comes from within the Karzai cabinet. I've written about it extensively. It's now admitted by U.S. government officials. Members of the Karzai cabinet in Afghanistan are big-time drug dealers, and they can't be touched because they're members of the cabinet. Well, we'd see that in spades in Cuba, because these very same Cuban lobby folks and Miami Cubans today who run a corrupt Miami are also involved with drug dealers. So that's why the Cubans are pretty sophisticated, and they understand that that's what they would have, and they'd rather see changes and reforms in the system they've got now than to risk the kind of chaos that would come under a U.S. plan.
Since 1962, the nation of Cuba has been under a pretty strict economic embargo that's basically been imposed by the United States, that's prevented a lot of economic traffic between the United States and Cuba. There was one particular scene in the famous Michael Moore movie Sicko that I wanted to bring to your attention. You probably know this. It's a scene where, well, simply Michael Moore and a bunch of Americans make a trip to Havana, and they visit a hospital, and a fairly nice one. Now, here's the thing, though. My sister actually brought this to my attention, and I wanted to get your take on this. Having to do with the healthcare system in Cuba with regards to this embargo, I imagine that, especially where Cuba has an international reputation for training and having a lot of doctors and a medical system that would certainly belie its status as a third world nation. But yet, this hospital that you see in the movie Sicko, my sister tells me, and maybe you can confirm or whatever, this hospital is actually one that's set up for tourists. It's actually one that, at least as I understand it, Americans, or not Americans, but Cubans themselves can't or don't use. Can you elaborate on this point? You know what I'm talking about?
It is true. They visited the best hospital in Cuba, and it's they have something called medical tourism, where people from mainly from South America who can't afford or need high-quality but inexpensive operations come. So if you need a heart transplant, for example, you can come to Cuba and relatively inexpensively get it done, and you're confident of the high quality of the medical care. Cubans can also get care there. It's not that they're excluded, but it is set up. It's the best, it'd be the Mayo Clinic or whatever, you know, the finest hospital in the land. And yes, he took, and I, frankly, I think Michael Moore should have mentioned that at least briefly in the story to put it in some kind of context. Cubans do, however, get free medical care, and that's something that we don't get here in the United States. Anything from a sprained ankle to a heart transplant is free. The way I describe it is that the medical system and educational system, which is also free, are personnel rich and resource poor. That is, they've got good quality doctors, professors, technicians, and so on, but they're often short of resources that we would take for granted. So you can go into a polyclinic and get eyeglasses or, you know, have a checkup or whatever. It's all free, but you maybe one day you go in and there's no x-ray film, and another day you go in, they write you a prescription, which is free, but you can't get the drugs because they don't have it. So it's those kind of shortages, and Cubans complain about it, but it's still way better than the medical systems, let's say, throughout the South America or indeed even much of the third world, because it applies not only to people in the cities, but to people out in the rural countryside. And that's unheard of in Latin America.
And those shortages that you allude to are to no small extent due to the embargo. Is that correct?
Well, that's certainly a part of it. In two ways. The certain specialized medical equipment is only made in the United States. Certain drugs are held, the patents are held by American drug companies. So in order to obtain those under the terms of the embargo, theoretically they can't buy them. In reality, they can, but they have to go through third countries and pay the higher shipping costs and the extra costs. So the estimate is that the cost of the Cuban economy boosts the cost about a 30% because of the U.S. embargo. And the other part of that is that because they can't sell sugar cane or nickel or pharmaceutical drugs to the United States, that hurts the Cuban economy as well. So it's hurt on both ends. They can't buy certain things and they can't sell to the U.S. That's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is the economy is not very well organized, and there's a lot of serious, anybody who visits Cuba can know immediately about the bureaucracy and the corruption and other serious problems, the lack of incentives to work in certain places. They've got a lot of economic changes they've got to make, and that's the other part of the problem.
I have here a promotional write-up about your book, Dateline Havana, and among the topics that are raised by this little write-up this write-up refers to what's called the Cuba Lobby. Let's discuss that for a little bit. What is the Cuba Lobby? What does that refer to? And how does it play a role in this entire set of affairs we've been discussing?
Well, the way the Cuba Lobby is most often defined is the group of conservative Cubans living in Florida and New Jersey who have a disproportionate impact on U.S. policy towards Cuba. I trace it back to the origins in the 1960s when, not long after the Cuban Revolution, the U.S., particularly the CIA and the Army, trained the Cuban exiles to carry out terrorist raids against Cuba. They sent them in to burn down cane fields and burn down department stores and kill civilians and a series of anything by any reasonable definition you would call terrorism. Later morphed those armed groups, continued for a good 10 years under the tutelage and the assistance and the financing from the U.S. They then went off on their own, kind of carried out policies independently, but with the support of the U.S., and they funded some of their activities through drug deals and alliances with drug dealers and involved with the Iran-Contra scandal, and I mean, there's a whole sordid history. By 1980, under the Reagan administration, they called together several top multimillionaires in the Cuban community, including Jorge Mascanosa, and put together the formation of the Cuban American National Foundation, CANF, which then became the main spokesperson for the kind of legal, political wing of the Cuba Lobby. Meanwhile, they continued a covert armed wing, basically paramilitaries who continued their armed attacks on Cuba, attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro numerous times, blowing up of hotels in Havana that caused the death of one Italian tourist and injuring a number of others. All of this was carried out by the Cuba Lobby, its armed wing, while not taking credit for it by the political wing. And that Cuba Lobby continues down to this day. And they are perceived perceived in Washington as being very powerful, and that every time there's an effort to modify or lift the embargo, they're Johnny on the spot threatening to donate money to your opponent and otherwise coerce people into voting their way. But they are weaker today than they have been in the past. The opinion polls show that 55% of Cubans living in Florida now oppose the U.S. embargo, want to see it lifted. And that's a huge change. 75% of the people in the United States oppose the embargo. So, democratically speaking, there's nobody in the U.S. that should be voting for the embargo, or certainly not the majority. So, I think we're going to see a real battle, because there's been some bills introduced just in the last couple of weeks to lift the embargo. Senator Richard Lugar, a conservative Republican, came out just 2 days ago with a statement saying U.S. policy towards Cuba has to change and we have to take another look at the embargo. Those are all very significant developments.
Just a quick follow-up question from what you just discussed. I can understand where Florida comes into play because, geographically speaking, it's practically right next to Cuba. But you had mentioned that there's a coterie of this Cuba lobby in New Jersey. Where does New Jersey fit into this?
Well, New Jersey fits in right next to New York. senator from New Jersey is a Cuban-American, one of the senators.
And, okay.
Basically, for years, even before 1959, Cubans immigrated to New York, and then some of them made their way over across the river there to New Jersey. So there's a large Cuban-American population, both immigrants and American-born, who live in New Jersey, and they have a disproportionate political impact in that state, as they do in Florida.
Okay. Let's discuss, the political left. It seems like that, in my opinion, in the United States among leftists, when the topic of Cuba comes up, it seems like there's this, I wonder if it's maybe an unhealthy dichotomy, and it kind of touches on what we have already discussed in the past, where you find that it's either that Cuba is absolutely wonderful and be above criticism, or that it's a horrible human rights repressive state that we basically have to be critical of. And it would seem like that both of these positions, I think, hold a little bit of a kernel of truth to them, but yet the situation itself is probably different from both of these held archetypes. What do you think accounts for this situation? Or is this maybe my perception of this?
No, I think that, I suppose it depends in part on how you define the left and who's in this left, but yes, those views that you just described are certainly there. There are people, and I criticize in my book the Fidelistas in this country who are such strong supporters of the revolution that they don't recognize or acknowledge its serious defects. And I, in the book, go into it in great detail. I think the other half of it is that there is repression in Cuba. There is jailing of political prisoners. There's no excuse for any political prisoners at all. There's no freedom of the press. The press is awful. Certainly the print and TV media are awful in Cuba. But you have to put it in a context, which is the U.S. has been trying to overthrow the government of Cuba since 1959. And, that's what the Bay of Pigs was all about. That's what the numerous assassination attempts sponsored by the CIA to kill Castro was all about. And the Cubans are in not only paranoid, but they have good reason to be paranoid. So they, when your government is threatened, you jail people and you crack down, and inevitably you make mistakes and jail people that shouldn't have been. So that's no excuse for it, but if the U.S. stopped its antagonistic attitudes towards Cuba, if it lifted the embargo, if it established normal relations, if it stopped trying to undermine and overthrow the government, I think we'd see a very different policies in Cuba as well.
And that's, I guess, where we can wrap up in this discussion. We're under a new presidency in the United States, one that would, in other spheres, seems to be a lot more open than maybe, well, certainly the Bush administration in the past 8 years, and perhaps even previous other Democratic administrations. It seems like that there might be a real sea change. And what do you think are the chances for a policy change in a new Congress, maybe a new environment, and certainly in an Obama administration? What do you foresee in the future regarding U.S. policy?
I think it's the best chance for change on Cuba policy that we've seen since the Carter years. The Obama administration is, I think they're going to. It's going to require pressure from below. I don't think the Obama administration will do it on its own. For one thing, Cuba is a very low priority issue after the economy and Iraq and Iran and Pakistan and Afghanistan. There's real hot button issues. Cuba is very low on the list. However, as I mentioned, the statement by Richard Lugar is very significant. He's the ranking Republican in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. A conservative Republican and liberal Democrat have introduced a bill into the House to lift the embargo or the travel restrictions on Americans going to Cuba. If that passes, that would be a huge change. That would be the end of the embargo, because the minute Americans get down there and see for themselves what's going on, the U.S. policy is just going to go up in flames. So I'm soberly optimistic. I think the Cuba lobby will put up a fierce fight against any of those changes, and depends how well the other side is organized and how much pressure there is on the Obama administration from below.
We've been speaking with Reese Ehrlich. He is an author and commentator. He's the co-author of the previous book, Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, and is the author of the newly published book, Dateline Havana, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Future of Cuba, who's been joining us on the phone right here in Chicago. Reese Ehrlich, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was an interview with Reese Ehrlich, recorded on February 25th, 2009. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.